Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025-2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Analogy in the semantics of simplicity, learning from the limits of theological language. The doctrine of divine simplicity poses challenges for accounts of how we can adequately express in language truths about God. For obvious examples, we can turn to Aristotle and Scripture. Aristotle's description of God as thought thinking itself in Book 12 of the Metaphysics is an attempt to capture a pure incomposite actuality using a sentence with subject-verb-object structure that identifies an agent with both its activity and the terminus of that activity. And the Exodus account of God's name revealed to Moses, "I am who am," also strains the rules of human grammar to express that common distinctions in creatures between the individual, what the individual is, and the being of the individual are somehow transcended by the Creator. Now, the kinds of challenges divine simplicity poses for an account of divine naming depend largely on prior assumptions about how language works in general. And so meeting the challenges may involve confirming, adapting, developing, or compromising those assumptions for cases of divine naming. To take an obvious and I think somewhat naive example, if your semantic framework held that concrete nouns serving as subject terms stand for individuals or objects, and that adjectives serving as predicate terms affirm attributes or properties of those individuals or objects, then the propositions God is just and God is wise signify respectively that the individual or object who is God has the property or attribute of being just and has the property or attribute of being wise. For this account of language, the doctrine of divine simplicity suggests first that the property of being just is the same as the property of being wise. Indeed, it suggests that all divine attributes or properties are really one divine attribute or property, which already seems pretty strange. But divine simplicity further suggests that God doesn't have this one property or attribute, but himself is this one property or attribute, which evidently sounds neither philosophically plausible nor particularly pious. And so, someone who clung to such an account of language and its semantic functions might treat this implication as evidence against the doctrine of divine simplicity and reject that doctrine. And we've heard of famous examples of people who've done that, Alvin Plantinga, William Lane Craig. Aquinas has a different account of how language works. And so he does not so much embrace this absurd conclusion that other philosophers reject, as he has a different conception of what the doctrine of divine simplicity is, and he finds that doctrine accompanied by a different set of challenges which arise within his different theoretical framework. The opportunity to explore this is the impetus for my talk. On the one hand, I want to see what we can learn about how Aquinas understands the doctrine of divine simplicity by seeing what kinds of challenges arise and how they are handled within his account of how language works. On the other hand, I want to see what we can learn about Aquinas' assumptions about how language works by seeing how his account of divine naming handles the doctrine of divine simplicity. A further consideration will focus my attention to language. For my contribution to this workshop, I was asked to focus on the famously important and contested topic for Thomistic scholars, analogy. This invitation was presumably based on the assumption that analogy is central to how Aquinas handles the doctrine of divine simplicity in his account of divine naming. I will somewhat confirm, but also complicate and somewhat reject that assumption. Here is my plan. I will start by offering an overview, introductory and schematic, of Aquinas' understanding of analogy. I will not enter into long-standing Thomistic debates, but will explain what I think is not commonly enough recognized, even among Thomists, and sometimes contributes to confusion in those debates, that there are two separate senses of analogy in Aquinas, one which pertains to relations between words, and one which pertains to relations between things. Next, I will turn to the doctrine of divine simplicity and show how, entirely apart from any question of linguistic puzzles or a discussion of divine names, the doctrine of divine simplicity assumes and exhibits one of the two senses of analogy in Aquinas, the one pertaining to relations between things. Then I will discuss two puzzles for meaningful expression about God that arise from the doctrine of divine simplicity, which Aquinas already partly addresses in question 3 of the Prima Pars, well before his explicit treatment of divine naming 10 questions later in question 13. Finally, I will discuss question 13, the question on divine naming. We will find that the other sense of analogy, the one pertaining to words, is introduced there, but that it is not crucially involved in the solution to most of the linguistic and semantic puzzles presented by the doctrine of divine simplicity, which are addressed rather by other resources in Aquinas' semantic framework. So part 1 of the talk is called Two Concepts of Analogy. There are two distinct concepts of analogy in Aquinas, which can, in certain applications, be connected, but even then must not be conflated. One concept of analogy is a kind of likeness between things. The other involves a relation between significations of terms. To take first analogy as a type of likeness. Likeness or sameness or unity between things can be particular or a matter of individual identity, as Socrates and the snub-nosed teacher of Plato are identical. It can be specific, as Socrates and Plato are both human beings. And it can be generic, as Socrates and a dog are both animals. But beyond generic likeness, there is a category of non-generic likeness, where instead of sharing some same feature or common form, there is a kind of relation between things that occupy different domains. This is classically expressed in terms of a ratio of ratios, or a proportionality, of the form A is to B as C is to D. A portrait of Socrates is certainly not identical with Socrates, and neither is it specifically or generically like Socrates. Rather, insofar as it is an adequate portrait, it has a proportional sameness to Socrates, which is to say, the domain of its two-dimensional surface somehow reproduces, in an appropriate mode for a different medium, the relations and shapes and proportions of parts of Socrates' actual facial features. The likeness or proportionality is between the relations between the parts of the portrait, the shapes of splotches of paint on the canvas, and the relations of Socrates' represented body parts existing in their own natural three-dimensional human mode. Analogy as a form of proportional sameness is used often in Aristotle, as in talking about particular virtues or excellences which perfect the flute player or the lyre player or the human being as such. And it is often used in his biological science to describe the function of one animal's organ as proportional to the function of another animal's organ. The scale is to the fish as the feather is to the bird. This proportionality relationship was what Aristotle called, in Greek, analogia. And it was derived from the mathematical concept of a ratio of ratios, useful in arithmetic to describe commensurable ratios, but also in geometry. For instance, a sphere is to a circle as a cube is to a square. The other concept of analogy is linguistic or logical. It involves a relation between significations of a term, and we can call it a form of associated meaning. Classically, it is understood as a mean between equivocation and univocation, and it is what most people mean when they consider analogy in Aquinas. Sometimes a given vocal or written word is to be deployed on different occasions, predicated of different things, with two unrelated meanings, as bank is predicated of the sides of a river and of a financial institution. We call this equivocation. Sometimes a word can be deployed on different occasions with exactly the same meaning, as animal predicated of a dog and a cat. We call this univocation. But it is possible for there to be some kind of middle ground, a mean between equivocation and univocation, where the meanings of the term, as deployed on different occasions, are in some way the same and in some way different. The most common example here is healthy, as predicated of an organism. of its food, and of its urine. As predicated of the organism, healthy signifies some balance of humors or homeostatic dynamism. As predicated of food, healthy is a cause of such animal healthiness, and as predicated of urine, it is a sign of such healthiness. Aristotle didn't call this linguistic phenomenon analogia in Greek. He called it a kind of homonymy with reference to one, prosthen equivocation, and some modern scholars have called it equivocation with focal meaning. What Aristotle's vocabulary makes plain is that these two concepts are logically distinct. You can have proportional likeness without associated meaning. In other words, two things can be apprehended as having a proportionality relationship without there being any common word predicated of both. Conversely, you can have associated meaning without non-generic likeness. As is evident in the case of healthy predicated of animal, its food, and its urine, the association between the secondary meanings and the primary meaning of the term is a relation of causality without any suggestion of proportionality or non-generic likeness. The two can appear together, but in that case, one would need there to be a term exhibiting associated meaning where the relation between the different meanings expressed a proportional relationship in things, as Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics suggests is the case with the term good, which always indicates a fulfillment of function, but across different modes or domains of being, conceived in terms of the proportionality relationship. These logically distinct notions are operative in Aquinas, but this is somewhat disguised by the fact that in scholastic Latin, analogia had migrated from its original Greek meaning for the proportionality relationship between things to include also and even primarily, but not exclusively, the linguistic notion of a mean between univocation and equivocation, the relationship of associated meaning between words. So on any given occasion of Aquinas's use of analogy, one must be attentive to context to determine which of the two analogy concepts he is deploying. And I won't read it, but the longest text on the handout is text number one. It's one of the very few cases where Aquinas actually uses both senses of the term analogia and tries to suggest a way in which they could be connected. But usually if he's using the term analogia in Latin, he has one of those concepts or the other in mind, and you can't always tell apart from context. This very broad overview is your introduction to Aquinas on analogy, a sketch clarifying two senses of analogy. You should note that neither concept of analogy is essentially theological, although, as we shall see now, they are both relevant to how we can understand the doctrine of divine simplicity. So the second part of this talk is called Divine Simplicity, Actuality, and Proportionality. Taking the structure of the Summa Theologiae seriously as having a pedagogical intent, I want to start with an observation about the placement of the Summa's discussion of simplicity relative to the Summa's discussion of divine naming. One might have thought that the issue of analogy as associated meaning would arise first, as a key to the issue of divine naming, which would prepare for a discussion of particular divine attributes, which would eventually lead to a consideration of how those attributes are identical with each other and with God. In this imagined order of inquiry, there are logical and epistemological problems about grasping God to be tackled first, and then individual properties of the divine nature are considered separately, finally concluding to the strange and esoteric doctrine of divine simplicity. But in fact, the argument of the Summa moves in the opposite direction. Peculiarities of divine naming are not addressed until question 13, after a discussion of divine attributes in questions 4 through 11, which are all derived from a conclusion about divine simplicity in question 3, which is the very first conclusion reached after establishing the existence of God in question 2. So simplicity is a doctrine that doesn't depend on discerning other attributes first, and certainly not on a discussion of how we can name God. Indeed, considered as a truth about the divine nature, simplicity is apparently more basic than any of the other attributes. Again, and to summarize, as a matter of the plain order of instruction in the Summa, Aquinas does not explore attributes and then say they are all identical with each other and with the divine nature. Instead, he reaches first a conclusion about divine simplicity and draws from it various further attributes that God is perfect, good, infinite, omnipresent, immutable, eternal, and one, and only after that does he treat some peculiarities of language as applied to God. The main observation I want to make about divine simplicity, and the subsequent discussion of attributes is that the semantic sense of analogy as associated meaning, the mean between unification and equivocation, is not invoked in these questions. Instead, what obviously is at stake is the metaphysical sense of analogy as non-generic likeness, a relation of proportionality. In fact, in the discussion of divine simplicity, I see the notion of analogy as proportional likeness operative in three stages. First, the very notion of actuality depends on perceiving relations of proportionality. Aristotle in the Metaphysics says that actuality cannot be defined, and as a first principle is reached only by an inference, by analogy, that is, discerning relations of proportionality. Here is Aquinas commenting on the passage from Aristotle in the Metaphysics. This is text 2 on the handout. And he, Aristotle, says that we can see what actuality is by means of the proportion existing between things. For example, we may take the proportion of one who is building to one capable of building, of one who is awake to one asleep, and of one who sees to one whose eyes are closed, although he has the power of sight. And of that which is separated out of matter, that is, what is formed by means of the operation of art or of nature, and thus is separated out of unformed matter, to what is not separated out of unformed matter. And similarly, we may take the proportion of what has been prepared to what has not been prepared, or of what has been worked on to what has not been worked on. But in each of these opposed pairs, one member will be actual and the other potential. And thus, by proceeding from particular cases, we can come to an understanding in a proportional way of what actuality and potency are. In short, even acquiring the notion of actuality depends on perceiving non-generic likenesses, the proportional relationship between potency and actuality in different particular modes. Second, the doctrine of divine simplicity is derived by via negativa, denying the composition of act and potency in God. Here is Aquinas in the first article of question 3. He's arguing that God does not have a body, but the thesis that God is pure actuality without admixture of potency is derived first and is the basis for this conclusion. This is text 4 on the handout. I believe it's text 4. Yeah, text 3, which I'm skipping, is simply Aquinas' map of what he's doing in all of question 3. So this is question 3, article 1, the body. The first being must be fully actual and in no way in potentiality. For even though in one and the same thing that goes from potentiality to actuality, the potentiality is temporarily prior to the actuality, nonetheless, absolutely speaking, actuality is prior to potentiality, because what is in potentiality is led into actuality only by a being that is in actuality in a relevant respect. But it was shown above, question 2, article 3, that God is the first being. Therefore, in God there cannot be anything in potentiality. But all bodies are in potentiality, since a continuous thing as such is infinitely divisible, therefore it is impossible for God to be a body. Nor is this the only place that Aquinas appeals to the notion of God as pure actuality. In question 3, I started having this conversation with Father Brent about this yesterday. God's pure actuality is invoked in each of the next 5 articles. Since God is pure actuality, he cannot be composed of matter and form. That's in Article 2. God must be divinity itself, the nature godhood, that is the essence or actualizing principle that he is. That's Article 3. Form and nature is actualized by esse. So God's essence is the same as his esse. That's Article 4. Genus is related to difference and subject is related to accident, as potency is related to actuality, and so there is no such composition in God. That's Articles 5 and 6. So while pedagogically Aquinas chooses a specific type of composition for each of the first 6 articles, he argues in each case that God as pure actuality is one of the reasons such a composition cannot be found in God. His method takes relations of parts in known composite beings and attempting to proportionally extend them to the different mode of being of the first cause as pure actuality, he finds that the composed elements may still be conceptually distinct, but there can actually be no real such distinction in God. To make the proportionality schema plain, the logic of each of the first 6 articles is to reflect on relations of parts A to B in creatures, to discover something about the proportional relationships of parts C to D in God, And each time, he discovers that since God is pure actuality, either C, as pure actuality, can in no way be associated with D, which can thus have no reality in God, or D must be so associated with C as to be wholly identified with C in God. The attempt in reasoning from effect to cause is that we find in some way in God what we find in created things, but in a radically different mode. Bodies and matter, will it be in God in no way at all? Articles 1 and 2. Essence is found in God not as what he has, but as what he is. Article 3. Being is found as God in God not as actualizing some essence, but as identical with the essence that he is. Article 4. This essentially actualizing essence that is God thus is not subject to because it transcends the composition of genus and difference. Article 5. And the composition of substance and accident. Article 6. The third way in which analogy as a metaphysical relation of proportionality is involved in the exploration of divine simplicity is in Aquinas' discussion of how certain divine attributes follow from divine simplicity. Since simplicity is conceived of in terms of God's pure actuality, Aquinas argues in the subsequent questions that God is most perfect, question 4, good, 5 and 6, infinite, question 7, omnipresent, question 8, immutable, 9, eternal, 10, and 1, question 11. At the beginning of this series of questions, Aquinas makes plain that he is thinking in terms of the proportionality relationship with the first use of analogy in the Summa in a manner that is clearly a matter of non-generic likeness, not a matter of associated meaning. This is text 5, it's question 4, article 3. If there is an agent not contained in any genus, its effects will still more distantly reproduce the form of the agent, not, that is, so as to participate in the likeness of the agent's form according to the same specific or generic formality, but only according to some sort of analogy. So now I'm in part 3. Speaking of simplicity, two puzzles. Of course, while I've been focusing on analogy as proportionality in its role in discovering and explicating divine simplicity, we have seen that this has odd consequences for how we talk about God. God is divinity. God doesn't have being, but is his esse. Simply formulating these claims makes us aware that our language may be limited in its ability to express the full truth of a simple God. I find two specific puzzles for theological language in question 3, which we shall now turn to. What I am calling the first puzzle is in Article 3, Question 3, Reply to the First Objection. That's text number 6 on your handout. We can speak of simple things only as though they were like the composite things from which we derive our knowledge. Therefore, in speaking of God, we use concrete nouns to signify his subsistence, because with us only those things subsist which are composite. And we use abstract nouns to signify his simplicity. In saying, therefore, that Godhead or life, these are abstract, or the like are in God, we indicate the composite way in which our intellect understands, but not that there is any composition in God. So the puzzle is that human discourse reflects the composition of composite things so that there is something inadequate about it when we stretch it to discuss a simple God. To explain this inadequacy, Aquinas here introduces a distinction between what words signify and how they signify what they signify. Human nature is what is signified by the term man and is predicated of Socrates when we say that Socrates is a man. But that same human nature can be signified in a different mode, abstractly instead of concretely, by the term humanity. And we don't say that Socrates is humanity, rather we say that he has humanity. In general, human grammar signifies natures either in concrete or abstract modes, depending on whether we mean to signify it as the whole of something or merely as a part. But when it comes to signifying the divine nature, the implications of concrete and abstract modes of signifying fall short of the reality of God's mode of being. God is not an individual who has a nature, nor is he an abstract nature. We can call God God, and we can also call God the Godhead. And the first term signifies God concretely, the latter abstractly, but they are the same thing, and God himself transcends the distinction between abstract and concrete modes as these are found in composite beings. This brings me to the second puzzle that I find in question 3. This is in Article 4, Add 2. It's text number 7 on your handout. To be can mean either of two things. It may mean the act of essence, or it may mean the composition of a proposition affected by the mind in joining a predicate to a subject. The second sense of to be is the sense of the truth of a proposition. Taking to be in the first sense, we cannot understand God's existence nor his essence, but only in the second sense. We know that this proposition, which we form about God when we say God is true, and this we know from his effects. While the first puzzle was on the level of how words signify as expressions of the first act of intellect, simple apprehension, this second puzzle is on the level of how propositions are true as expressions of the second act of intellect, judgment. We want to express true propositions about God, but the very nature of human propositions reflects a human mode of understanding that apprehends truth in terms of composing and dividing. Given God's simplicity as pure actuality, truths about him are not a matter of additional features or forms added to or combined with him. And so the very structure of propositional language with subject and predicate seems inadequate. Here in question 3, Aquinas handles this puzzle by admitting that our propositions don't capture the divine essence, but only assert truths about the divine essence learned from effects. He will not fully address this puzzle of propositional inadequacy until question 13, to which we will now turn. So we're in part 4 of the talk, divine naming. We've already seen that after question 3 on simplicity, Aquinas explores various truths about God or divine attributes, and then in question 13 addresses directly the topic of divine names. There is a common misconception that divine naming is primarily an issue of analogy. I've already complicated that picture by distinguishing two concepts of analogy, the proportionality relationship between things and associated meanings expressed by terms. And we have seen that the former is thoroughly implicated in Aquinas' natural theology long before any explicit treatment of divine naming. Now I will further complicate the story by arguing that the latter, analogy as associated meaning, is only one relatively minor part of the treatment of divine naming. Analogy as associated meaning is really treated only in Articles 5 and 6 of question 13. And I think there's a summary, Aquinas' own summary of 13 is text 9 on the handout. There Aquinas presents what is a standard and consistent teaching of his other works, that words said of God and creatures are on the one hand not univocal, and on the other hand not purely equivocal. Instead, they operate as a mean between these two, signifying in God and creatures what is in some sense the same and in some sense different. Since this implies an order of priority with a primary analogate and secondary analogates, Aquinas argues in Article 6 that the order of priority depends on whether we are thinking about the order of learning and the order of imposition, and then the significations originate in and are proper to creatures, or the order of causality, so that what is signified is most properly in and said of God. But question 13 considers several other dimensions of divine naming that are not handled by appealing to analogy as associated meaning. Articles 1 and 2 argue that our modes of conceiving and signifying God don't have to correspond to God's mode of being, so our words can genuinely signify what God is, without claiming to define or comprehend his nature, and while having their conceptions derived from creatures. As he considers in Article 3, it follows that predications can be more than merely metaphorical, but genuinely proper in what they signify, while being inadequate with respect to their mode of signification. As an aside, I would note that discussions of modes of signifying is, in Aquinas, distinct from the matter of analogy as associated meaning. Modes of signification have more to do with the grammatical implications of terms and how what they signify is realized in things, not with different possibly associated senses of what is signified by different uses of the same term. Despite some modern interpretations, Aquinas never says that analogy involves a common res significata, thing signified, and diverse modes of signification, or modi significandi. Aquinas next considers whether the doctrine of divine simplicity implies that different substantial predicates that are true of God are all synonymous. He says they are not, because the one simple nature of God can be genuinely grasped by us under different concepts or rationes. That's Article 4. After addressing analogy as associated meaning in Articles 5 and 6, Aquinas considers other features of human language that seem to be inapplicable to God. Our verbs are tensed, implying time, but Aquinas says in Article 7 that different ways of signifying a relation make it clear that time applies to creation and not to God. In Article 8, he gives a similar solution to explain how predications derived from operations can still signify the divine nature. In Article 9, Aquinas explains the sense in which the word God, as a grammatically shareable or communicable term, in fact behaves more like a proper name that is not shared by multiple individuals. In Article 10, he explains how significations of the term God in heretical usage are related to its signification in orthodox use. And in Article 11, he explains how the biblical name, He Who is the most proper name for God, not only because of what it signifies, but because its mode of signifying draws attention to the limits of human language. Finally, and as a kind of culmination of question 13, he returns in Article 12 to the question initially treated in question 3, Article 4, whether it is possible to make true affirmations about God. Given that God is simple, but human propositional discourse implies a composition of predicate and subject. Human propositions, reflecting the human mode of knowing by composing, do not perfectly represent the truth of a simple God, but they are also not wholly inadequate. Even though our intellect understands God under diverse conceptions, he says, it nonetheless knows that one and the same reality, absolutely speaking, corresponds to all these conceptions. Therefore, the intellect represents a conceptual diversity by means of the diversity of predicate and subject, while it represents unity by means of the composition of predicate and subject. That this does not entail falsehood is explained in response to the third objection. Falsehood involves not simply understanding things as other than as they are, but understanding them to be other than as they are. So while a human intellect can only understand simple things in a composite way, it is not limited by this mode of understanding to believe those simple things actually to be composite. So note that here in question 13, article 12, as back in question 3, Aquinas' account of how it is possible to make true affirmations of a simple God does not rely on any appeal to the semantic sense of analogy as associated meaning, a mean between equivocation and univocation. However, Aquinas does presume a conception of divine actuality as non-generically analogous to created actualities, and so he strongly depends on the sense of analogy as proportional likeness among things. And in general, what Aquinas draws on to account for the possibility of coherent theological speech is not a particular kind of term having an analogical signification, but the entire resources available to him in a semantic theory that attends to the ways that the whole structure of language, including not just signification but modes of signification, is adapted to a reality replete with analogical relationships, especially in the different modes of act and potency. In this sense, my reflections on analogy and divine simplicity could serve as a prelude and invitation to pursue more fully Aquinas' semantic realism and explore how it differs from other semantic frameworks in which the doctrine of divine simplicity is harder to formulate and might not even seem to arise as a coherent theological possibility at all. But in conclusion, and you can thank me, I won't go there. I will end instead by reviewing the ground we have covered. There are two senses of analogy in Aquinas, one metaphysical, the non-generic likeness of proportionality, and one linguistic or semantic, the associated meaning that lies between univocation and equivocation. The basis for the doctrine of divine simplicity is the understanding of God as pure actuality, and analogy as proportional likeness plays a crucial role in learning about actuality and extending this already flexible notion to the limit case of God. This leads to puzzles about how to capture the truth of an absolutely simple, pure actuality in human language adapted to expressing the truths of composite beings. And in addressing these linguistic challenges, analogy as associated meaning plays a relatively small role. For Aquinas, other aspects of his semantic framework, especially the notion of modes of signification and the clarification that we can be aware of the inadequacies of our language even while using it, are more crucial to the possibility of divine naming. So properly speaking, it is not analogical naming but the entire resources of his semantic realism that help Aquinas to formulate and address the challenges of Thomistic metaphysics and natural theology, including especially the peculiar thesis of divine simplicity that comes so naturally within his conceptual framework, but seems to lose its sense when articulated in alternative frameworks. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.